Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Hello there, I'm Ann Thompson, editor-at-large for IndieWire.
And I'm IndieWire's deputy film editor, Ryan Latanzio.
And we're the co-hosts of IndieWire's weekly Screen Talk podcast.
Join us each week for an in-depth discussion of the latest in film and TV industry news, with special guests along the way, including filmmakers and executives.
Hear from us every Friday morning on iHeart platforms or wherever you get your podcasts, as IndieWire shares what we've learned from the movie week that was.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas.
Hey, Julie, have you ever renovated a house?
I have. I have to tell you that wallpaper removal is the scourge of all renovators. It's awful.
That's gross. I've never had to do that. I've had to scrape tiles off of hardwood floors, but that's about it.
I don't know. I haven't done that, actually, so I can't say if it's worse. But I can say that from my own experience, you know, being in a really small room, you know, filled with fumes, like ethyl methyl kind of stuff, and trying to just inch by inch get, you know, flowered wallpaper from the 1940s off is a horrible thing.
Yellow women running around in them and all that, yeah.
Yes.
Because, it's rough with renovating, because you'll come into a house or a space that is, in some cases, unlivable.
Yeah.
And you have to put all this work into it just to get it up to the standard where you can be comfortable with the fact that you live in this space. And that's not even, you know, discussing the process of getting it where you want it to eventually be.
Exactly.
Affecting it, if you will.
Right.
Which can take forever and never happen.
That's right. It has to become habitable at some point.
Yes.
You got to get the pee-pee douchette scent out of the floor.
Yes.
Cat pee.
If possible.
There you go.
Sometimes it's a meth lab. Supposedly the same smell. Cat pee, meth lab. That's what they say.
Okay.
Yeah. But I tell you, a real fixer-upper out there that really, it's far rougher than any wallpaper issues you've had or tiles on the hardwoods that I've had, and that is the prospect of moving to the planet Mars.
Oh, yeah. That is screaming for a redo.
Yeah, that place is rough.
That garish red color.
Yeah, and I mean, it's just you couldn't live on Mars right now. I mean, that's kind of an overstatement of the obvious, but you could not live in it. You would have to terraform it, which is the planetary version of renovating a space.
Yeah, yeah. And at first I used to think about it as like a terrarium for humans.
Yeah.
Although there would be no dome.
Yeah.
But I like the idea of having this gigantic terrarium on Mars filled with humans. But that's really not what scientists are thinking.
Yeah, they're not thinking as much of that, but just sort of, but it does come down to, we really wish this place was a little more like Earth, because we want to be able to potentially live there.
Right.
What can we do to make it happen? And I, Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, so why do it? That's what I keep, you know, struggling with this topic. Like, why would you terraform Mars?
Yeah, now this is a big one because, it's hard to make the argument that we need to be on Mars right now. Unless, I mean, some people, if you're Robert Zubrin, head of the Mars Society.
Yesterday.
Yeah, then we should have been there yesterday.
100 years ago.
I mean, one of the big key arguments is that it has to do with the long-term survival of the human race.
Okay.
You know, that eventually we're going to have to become, an interplanetary, race. We're going to have to become an interstellar race.
Because we've, 6 billion of us right now, and we're not stopping.
We're growing. There's the Earth isn't going to last forever. And if we have this idea that we're going to last forever, we're going to need to expand out, diversify our planetary portfolio.
Okay. You know? And sort of like the Lorax, we've done a real number to our own environment, right?
Yeah.
So we want to try to maybe escape our atmosphere and go to a new virgin atmosphere that's all lush and pretty.
Yeah. It seems like you see less of that these days, but it seemed like that was a real driving force for a while. Like, all right, well, this one's about used up. What's next? But at a very basic level, if we're going to become an interplanetary, interstellar race, you got to take those baby steps, you know? So people talk about going to the moon, going to Mars.
Right.
And then it expands from there. The other side of it, and this is generally touted as more of a secondary argument, is that, in the same way that the Age of Discovery propelled scientific innovation, so too would the terraforming and eventual colonization of another world stir up a lot of technical innovation that would benefit life on Earth.
Yeah, actually, I even pulled a quote to that effect because I thought, well, that is interesting. That's the sort of view I can take on it and say, okay, it might be worth our time because indirectly we would get all this technology. Dr. Adrian Brown of SETI, with the Search for Extraterrestrial Life Institute, he had actually said something very similar to that, saying that we wouldn't have invented such precise timekeeping and navigational technology if we didn't need it in order to cross huge expanses of ocean to reach frontiers in Asia, Africa, and the New World. So he's using that same analogy for space.
Yeah.
Which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, it is. And then there's the whole argument, too, that to really understand Mars, we would need to be there. Now, I'm not sure how well that holds up with our continued advances in robotic exploration techniques.
Yeah.
But you definitely run across that argument. We're saying, like, if we want to get to the bottom of the possibility of life on Mars now or life in its distant path, and therefore understand the evolution of life in the cosmos better, then we're going to need to be there. So.
Well, and see, I do understand the argument too, but then I also kind of think, well, if you have samples that are collected by robots and sent back, you know, you have the data that you need.
Right.
And part of it's kind of like, you have to admit, it would be just really cool to be on Mars.
Yeah,
and that's a reason to go.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, we're, as of recording this, we're planning to go to South by Southwest.
Right.
To record something. It's kind of like if someone were to say, look, you really need to send us there. And if we're making the argument because it would also be cool, you know?
Yeah. It'd be a little different if we just sent like a little hologram of ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was on the table. We were saying, look, let's just send robot explorers to South by Southwest. And then we're like, no, because we won't get the full effect. And, you know, and we'll also have a more advanced technology for having to figure out how to send ourselves to it.
Right. So it's sort of a win-win for everybody.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. But so I'm also wondering, why Mars? Why not Venus?
Well, Mars is ultimately the better prospect. I mean, I don't want to get off on Venus, though Venus is fascinating.
Yeah.
But Venus is pretty messed up. I mean,
it's a hot mess.
Literally. It's a hot, highly pressurized, acid, clouded world. And Mars, it's just a little, it's like if you're looking at two houses, Mars is the better fix it up property.
Okay.
I think it's worth mentioning, like, exactly what's wrong.
Venus is the teardown.
Yeah. Yeah. Venus is more of a teardown, I guess.
Yeah.
There are terraforming schemes out there for Venus, but.
Yeah.
But we're going to focus on Mars just because it's an easier prospect to understand. And to understand what's exactly wrong with Mars, right? I feel like we need to look at that. So one of the big things. Terrible atmosphere. Just
awful.
Really bad.
Thin.
Yeah. Thin. You know, keep in mind that humans are evolved to live in a very small atmospheric level of our own world.
Right.
And
sort of a special sauce here that obviously isn't present on Mars.
Yeah. And there are layers of this special sauce where we die. You know, if you go up to the top of Everest without any kind of transition, then you wouldn't survive.
Most people.
Right. The Sherpas would do.
Yeah.
But they're used to it. So yeah, we wouldn't get enough oxygen. We'd die. It's just way too thin. It lacks sufficient air pressure and contains way too much carbon dioxide.
It's freezing too.
Yeah. It's also, yeah, really cold. It's the, to go back to the Goldilocks idea.
Yeah.
Venus is too hot. Mars is too cold.
Right.
Earth is just dry.
Right. And if you had just even a speck of water, the moment that it hit the surface, it would just sizzle and evaporate. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's also an important point to be made about the fact that there's no intact electromagnetic field.
Mm-hmm.
Earth has one. It's generated by hydrodynamic convection between the liquid outer core and the solid inner core.
Mm-hmm.
And without this shielding, we'd be exposed to a deadly stream of highly charged particles called the solar wind. So for reasons we don't entirely understand yet, Mars lacks the protection of this.
Yeah, so only... thank you, electromagnetic field, if
yeah.
we haven't thanked you lately.
Yeah, they have Mars has like only remnants of a magnetic field around its
right.
polar ice caps. So that's it's like not having a roof on a working roof on the house. We'd have to figure out how to replace the roof.
Right.
So yeah, it's that's pretty rough. But there's some potential on Mars. There, there is water on the Martian surface. And
right. There's evidence that there used to be quite a bit. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
There's carbon and oxygen in the form of carbon dioxide, and there's nitrogen. The problem is that it's like the atmosphere there is like 95.3% carbon dioxide. It's just
was it like a 0.01 or something?
Point
on Earth.
Yeah, and then and also on Mars, it's like the oxygen there is 0.2%. So
yeah,
really, really low.
So you're gonna have to supplement with oxygen and nitrogen, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to go and terraform this in earnest. Also, the rotation rate is on par with the Earth's 24-hour cycle.
Yeah.
And it's close enough to the sun to experience seasons, which is always lovely.
Because you want seasons when you live on other worlds.
Well, sure. You know, you want to have your winter home on one part and your summer home on the other.
Yeah. So
Richard Branson.
So then this comes to the question, what would it take to fix it up? What would it take to get that new roof on it, to bump up the atmosphere, to scrape the horrible wallpaper off the walls of Mars and make it look pretty again?
Yeah. Boy. And there are actually some very good ideas about this, right?
Yeah.
Good in the sense that they are solutions.
Yeah. And they're based in science. I think for a lot of people, like the idea of, like for me, the earliest experience I have with terraforming
mm-hmm.
was seeing, I think, aliens, and they had the big terraforming stations. And I only had a vague idea of what it was doing, that it was like these giant buildings that are like spitting out smoke are going to somehow transform this world into a place that humans can live on.
Okay.
Which,
so the greenhouse gas effect.
Yeah. A lot of it breaks down to that. Like our experience in screwing up our own world crosses over to some of the ideas for making Mars a little more like what we want.
Okay, so we want like big coal mining factories, is what you're saying.
Yeah, basically, one of the ideas, the aliens model, if you will, is to create these greenhouse gas producing factories. You know, they would be the same heating effect that we have here on Earth with greenhouse gases could be reproduced on Mars by setting up hundreds of these factories across the Martian surface.
And releasing CFCs.
Yeah, CFCs, methane, carbon dioxide, other greenhouse gases, just pump it into the atmosphere, just mm-hmm. basically pollution machines on Mars to try and it's kind of like on Mars it's like the water's a little too hot, so we're gonna add some cold water to cool the bath down,
right?
And on Mars it's the reverse.
Yeah,
so that's one scheme. Another involves large orbital mirrors to reflect the sunlight and heat the Martian surface. All right, this would, you know, giant mirrors, kind of like the ones that the Soviets experimented with for the idea of giving sunlight to dark regions during mm-hmm. the winter. And these would concentrate light onto the polar caps and melt the ice. This would release carbon dioxide, believed to be trapped inside the ice.
Okay.
And the rise in temperatures would, over the years, would conceivably release greenhouse gases such as these CFCs, the same that you find in your air conditioner or
okay.
refrigerator.
So like melting polar caps, and then this would all lead to photosynthesis at some point.
Right.
Right. But years and years and years. And
yes,
again,
years,
we're talking, one of the things I think to think about is, you know, you had some people say it could take centuries, and you have other people saying it could take thousands and thousands of years.
Yeah. One of the important things is that when you're talking about changing an atmosphere, you get into this whole area of fluid dynamics. You get into just the chaos theory itself.
Yeah.
Just a refresher, the idea that the chaos theory emerged from the attempt to create more reliable computer models of weather, of how our atmosphere works.
Mm-hmm.
And the chaos theory is that you can only figure it out so far, and then it just breaks down.
Right.
So we're up against that in trying to figure out how to tinker with another world's atmosphere. We don't fully understand how our own works, or we at least the thing we understand the most about it is that it's incredibly complex.
Right.
So there are a lot of what-ifs that end up falling into it, and different people's figures we'll say decades, and another we'll say centuries.
Well, and then there's the whole dark matter out in space, the fact that we don't really know what exactly it is and how it affects planets,
mm-hmm.
right? So, and then we actually talked about this yesterday, about the possibility of smashing ammonia-heavy asteroids into the planet,
yes.
To sort of create the same greenhouse gas level effect.
Now, this is another one that's Robert Zubrin is really fond of and presented in his book, A Case for Mars. And Zubrin is a really interesting guy. I got to interview him for a Discovery News article.
Yeah.
And I don't think I've ever interviewed somebody just so passionate about their thing. And I've interviewed plenty of people who are really passionate about their topics and their life's work. But Zubrin is indeed, he's just like, we should be on Mars yesterday. And
yeah.
Here's why.
Yeah. I listened to that audio file, and at the risk of, Robert Zubrin, like, reaching out to me and saying, you know, you're the devil incarnate. That dude is a fanatic. But I kind of like that, because you need those people. You need that passionate level
exactly,
in order to be like, we got to do this, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you need extremists or an extremely passionate people to push these ideas into the public mindset. Otherwise, there too many people will just not listen.
Right. Yeah. And also, you know, I know this is a little bit of an aside. I was thinking about him, and I was thinking about his role, and I thought, even if this doesn't happen right now, I mean, he very well may be like the Da Vinci in the sense of his time, and that, you know, Da Vinci had all these drawings for flight, but obviously the technology didn't exist until much, much later. And, you know, who knows? People could go down in history and be like, that Zubrin guy was righteous.
Yeah.
He knew what he was talking about.
And he was ahead of his time. We should have been on Mars in the 20th century.
Right. That being said, let's talk about the ammonia-ridden asteroid, which is a little bit creepy.
Well, it's another one of these ideas that's just very catastrophic sounding.
Yeah.
Because you're messing with the planet's atmosphere. It's very reminiscent of some of the scenarios we look at with things like nuclear winter or asteroids impacting the Earth.
Right.
And this basically boils down to the belief that if you hurled these large icy asteroids that were just full of ammonia at Mars, they would produce tons of greenhouse gases and water. Okay, so you would need nuclear thermal rocket engines, and you'd have to somehow attach these to an asteroid from the outer solar system, and then the rockets would move the asteroids in about 4 kilometers per second for a period of about a decade before the rockets would shut off and allow the 10 billion ton asteroids to glide unpowered toward the Martian surface.
Mm-hmm.
And the energy released upon impact would be about 130 million megawatts of power.
And can you imagine the dust settling from that? I mean, it would take centuries and centuries.
And it's now that you mentioned dust, that's another scheme that's out there, is to take material from a C-class asteroid or a Martian moon and spread it over Mars' polar caps. So this would be another kind of drastic global warming type of scheme. Coat it with dust. The poles would then absorb more solar radiation. Cause remember, you'd have, you know, you wear a dark shirt on a sunny day, you're warmer than if you wear a white shirt.
Right.
It's the same scenario.
You're absorbing more sunlight.
Yeah. They absorb more sunlight, causing them to heat up, release carbon dioxide, atmospheric pressure, increases, and you'd have the greenhouse effect. And eventually we get it up to the point where Arnold Schwarzenegger's eyeballs would explode if he took his helmet off. That's the ultimate goal.
Sweet.
In all things, but also in terraforming.
All right. So, I mean, I guess that is the point where then people could be supplemented with oxygen and nitrogen to a certain degree, but not like full on like they would need right now.
Yeah. Any of these schemes you're looking at, it's not, you wouldn't be able to turn Mars into, you know, Idaho in a decade or a century. You know, there would be this long, slow process of where it becomes more Idaho-esque.
Yeah, and I guess that sort of plays into the outmoded idea that this would be a population outlet for Earth, right? Like if we reached 20 billion people, by the time we reached 20 billion people, you'd have to assume that we would have had some sort of solution in place, because by the time that you can actually have Mars habitable, it would be thousands and thousands and thousands of years from now.
Yeah.
So that's one of the arguments of like, hey, let's not try to, this shouldn't probably be our backup plan for humanity. Right.
Plus I like to, or I don't like to think this, but, it seems like if the more we move towards potentially having more world peace, that's just going to get in the way of people needing to leave here. So if we got to the point where we had the technology to go to other worlds and seed them with our people, you might want to make, conditions on Earth particularly hellish. And then people would have a reason to flee, right?
Right, right.
Same model as the early or just a good reason to make tons and tons of money, which is another huge factor. You get into like mining on Mars for helium-3 and things like that. Then you could conceivably see it being a possibility.
Yeah, yeah. Halliburton's all over this. So this also kind of plays into the ethics, right? There's,
yes.
There's actually like, kind of like a science gang war going on here, and it's like the reds and the greens.
Yeah.
I'm not kidding. Like the reds are the folks who are like, you know what? Maybe we should look at Mars and try to keep it intact as much as possible and still study it, but keep the integrity of it because maybe there's something that its ecosystem can tell us. And if we were to try to terraform it, we would sort of pollute that possibility of learning more about it.
Yeah. It's the idea that there might be some little signs of what life may have been like on Mars, if there was life on Mars, at some point in the past.
Right.
Those secrets are buried, and those secrets are there to be found, provided that we don't completely contaminate the place. It's like a controlled crime scene. You don't want the bumbling local detectives to go and local police officers to come in and touch everything, because the big city detective, he needs to get in there with all his high-tech gear and figure out what's what.
Right. Like, we wouldn't want to introduce an invasive microbial species that would just, lay waste to everything.
Yeah.
Because then we'd be like, oh, we didn't learn anything really about Mars. Now we're just trying to fit our earthly paradigm, into Mars, this other thing, which we don't really know about yet.
Yeah.
Yeah. So those are the reds.
Yes. And then the greens, of which Zubrin is definitely a member.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, his whole thing is like, this is... he put it really nicely in the interview I did with him, and I'm sure he's used this exact example many times, but he's like, if you were to make the argument, hey, let's take Earth and let's turn it into a barren, lifeless world. Let's do that. Let's get started in this project right away. You would say, dude, you're crazy. Don't turn the planet, this living, lush planet, into a desert.
Right.
And his thing is, then the reverse is true too. That the argument, like, look at Mars, it's dead, it's empty, there's nothing living there, it's a wasteland. We have a responsibility to turn it into a green world.
See, and that's the problem I have with it, because it's like absolutism, right?
Yeah.
It's like, it's dead.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, I don't know. Because NASA actually has said, well, there are these methane plumes that keep kind of unfurling in front of us, making us realize that there's methane being released, which kind of points us in the direction that there may be some sort of life form, at least on a microbial level.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can't necessarily pronounce it dead.
Yeah. I guess it's kind of like if there was like a house in a neighborhood and it was like really crappy and someone was made the argument, hey, we need to fix this up. It's doing nothing. It's just a complete, ruin. It's, foreclosed on. Let's get somebody in there. Let's get this thing torn down and rebuilt or something.
Right.
And then you can make the argument, well, feral cats are living there. Those feral cats need to live somewhere. So why not this house? Or there's making some argument that something natural may be going on that we shouldn't stamp on just yet.
Yeah, or they might say there's a Tiffany stained window in there.
Yeah.
You can't knock that down.
Exactly. Okay, that's an even better example. Yeah.
So I don't know. I think it's a very fascinating topic, and I do really like the idea of technology coming out of the thought experiment of
it.
But obviously it's something that that we're, at least in the United States, we don't necessarily have the economic power to put a lot of money into. Particularly since some of these plans, like there's a $450 billion plan rolled out in the Bush 1 era that was like, hey, we can build this orbital platform on Mars and launch this and do this. And Bush was like, I don't think so. And there have been subsequent plans. In fact, Zubrin came up with a couple of pretty good ones that are more in like the $20 to $50 billion range. Still, that's
still a lot of money. It's sad to think. At some point in the past, somebody made the argument and I forget who was saying, maybe it was just a friend I was talking to, but they were like, we're not going to see a person land on Mars in our lifetime. Now, whether that's true or not remains to be seen, but just the prospect's kind of sad because you grow up watching all this science fiction right. and hearing all this science. And, you know, we've been talking about landing on Mars for well over half a century. I mean, we've been talking about it longer than that, but we've had more concrete plans in that time period. And to think that it's not going to happen is kind of depressing because you kind of grow up thinking that this is where your life is going to go, you know?
Yeah, yeah, and hence Zubrin in his his impatience.
Yeah,
and saying, "Look, we do have the technology; we could do it."
Yeah,
I mean, it's plausible.
Yeah, and of course, the more we learn, though, you know, the more the situation becomes complicated because there's a 2010 study from the Swedish Institute of Space Physics and the University of Leicester, and they found that double solar radiation waves periodically strip away 30% of the sparse Martian atmosphere. So these waves occur when one solar wave overtakes another to produce a single, like, super wave.
Yeah.
And so what little atmosphere remains on the planet is due to comet strikes and the occasional melting of polar ice. So even if it kind of creates this horrible situation. It's like the money pit, like you're going to rebuild it
right.
and then stuff's just going to bust it down.
Right.
So I'm not saying we shouldn't try, but it's a little disheartening to have that added bit of information.
Well, and I was thinking, too, that astrobiology, which we've talked about before, is still such a young field in terms of the new technologies it has at its disposal.
Right.
You know, what might it be able to uncover in the next 10 years to tell us a little bit more about Mars and how to look at that situation and look at terraforming anew? So I don't think that we have all the data in. What we're talking about here.
Yeah, no, yeah. We should definitely not shut the case, shut the lid on the case just yet.
Yeah.
I like to think it'll happen someday. We'll see.
We'll see.
Yeah.
Let's bring on the mail.
Yes, we do have a couple of bits of mail here from some people who have some experience with doppelgangers.
Oh, yeah.
Calling back to our Defeat Your Doppelgangers podcast. First, we're going to hear from Matt. Matt says, "Hey guys, love the podcast. Just listen to your show, Defeat Your Doppelgangers. This one really hit home with me because as a young kid, I always had the impression that there were multiple copies of myself hanging around my hometown. I never felt there was any malicious intent or an evil clone. I always knew in the back of my mind that around any corner I might bump into a copy of myself. I never found one, but to this day, I still have a feeling that they are out there somewhere. Also, as a kid, I always thought that the mirror in my bathroom, or any mirror, was actually a view into the closest relative neighborhood dimension. That is to say, a looking glass into the closest dimension to ours. The image staring back at me was not a reflection, but the other me from the next dimension looking in his mirror."
Whoa.
Yeah. So, Matt, thanks for sharing that. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, yeah. My mind is a little bit blown there.
Yeah.
I also wanted to share, too, there's a comment by Jane on Facebook, and she was talking about our Neanderthals episode. And she actually made a really good point that in that episode, we kept referring to Neanderthals as he.
Yes.
There's, like, no mention of any female Neanderthals, which, of course, we know that existed. In fact, that's the mitochondrial DNA that tells us so much today about what went on with Neanderthals. They, the possessors of it. And she also points out that when we were talking about them making glue and so on and so forth, we kept talking about he doing it. And I thought, you know what, that's a really good point to make. Thank you, Jane. Thank you for keeping us sharp because, you know, it's kind of hard sometimes you fall back on that old, he pronoun as a catch-all.
Uh-huh.
So I just wanted to say, yes, the Neanderthals, the ladies, They were definitely a big part of that group, and it was interesting because a lot of the research that I came across, at least, and especially the stuff that was produced online, shows this sort of patriarchal paradigm of the men making the glue and like the women going through the men's hair and grooming them, and the men barking Neanderthal orders out of them. So. Anyway, again, thank you, Jane. And I love these comments that you guys give us, you know, via email and Facebook. And you guys really give us some good, thoughtful insight. Stuff for our minds to chew on as well.
Indeed. One more quick doppelganger. Eric writes in, he says, "I've never met anyone who could be my twin, but I have had some problems with my name. My name doppelganger, as in a doppelganger that shares one's name.
Right.
I moved to Portland, Oregon in 2005 from the San Francisco Bay Area. When I applied for a library card here, I was surprised to learn that there were unpaid overdue books under my name. Turns out, someone with my name, please don't read it on the air, and gives his full name, is also living
Richard
in the
Branson.
Is also living in the suburb of Portland. The town has a population of a little less than 23,000 people. So, yeah, that happens probably more frequently. We encounter individuals that share our exact name, and especially if you end up Googling your own name like I do way too much. You know, it's like, when am I going to overtake the murderer Robert Lamb? When am I going to overtake the He-Man, the animated series animator?
Yeah, mine, I think I'm like a Julie Douglas as maybe a triathlete somewhere in Austria or something. I can't remember. I haven't Googled myself for a long time. But I was like, you go, Julie Douglas.
Yeah, the Julie Douglases of the world need to stick together and make it work, right?
Yeah. I just did a little fist bump to you guys out there, Julie Douglases.
Well, cool. If you have any little tidbits to add or just want to interact with us, then head on over to Facebook or Twitter. You'll find us as Blow the Mind on both of those. We keep that updated with all sorts of good stuff.
And you can always drop us a line at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. To learn more about the podcast, click on the podcast icon in the upper right corner of our homepage. The HowStuffWorks iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
The Toolkit Podcast is where your favorite filmmakers come to talk about their craft and process.
I don't want a sloppy angle in my movie ever.
It's like being a dancer. You find the freedom in the structure.
It's where Tarantino, Gerwig, Scorsese, and Jordan Peele discuss their latest films, and showrunners take us behind the scenes of the best of TV.
Hosted by IndieWire's craft team, Toolkit is an award-winning podcast that gets at the heart of what really matters for filmmakers, like Spike Lee.
It comes back to this storytelling. What can I use in my toolbox?
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.